Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have my guest today, Robert Taylor, who is the author of A New Way to Be Human, Seven Spiritual Pathways to Becoming Fully Alive. Robert has a foreword by Desmond Tutu, who is a Nobel Peace Laureate, and was also a friend of my spiritual parents, who spent a great deal of time in South Africa. Robert is originally from South Africa and had some very important choices to make very early in life, and had some very interesting guidance, and chose to walk the path where he had to overcome his fears and thereby learn these principles. Thank you for joining us today, Robert.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you, Susan, and I love the fact that we have that South African connection through your parents.
Yes, yes. They spent a great deal of time in South Africa working with releasing techniques, which were so important because of all of the history of violence in the country.
Yes. What a gift.
Forgiveness. You're familiar with that concept.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, right. Well, would you like to tell our guests, our listeners, a little bit about your story and how your path unfolded, because it was very interesting to me to see each choice you had to make and what you dealt with making it.
Well, yeah, I'd love to, Susan. You know, just hearing you talk about forgiveness, I think one of the themes that your listeners will find in the book is the way in which I talk about learning to and making choices about forgiveness in our life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a choice for most of us, and terrible things happen to many, if not all of us, over the course of our journey in our life. And when we make a choice to forgive, we actually say, I'm no longer going to be imprisoned by the action of another person, which doesn't mean that the reality of some terrible thing disappears.
Right.
But we begin to live with a different state of mindfulness and awareness about just who we are and how we engage in the world. So, and out of that, we're able to begin to develop compassion, and compassion for ourselves, which leads to compassion for others. And I've certainly learned about all of this in a very personal way in growing up in South Africa, becoming aware of the violence and destruction of apartheid, and, you know, a system that essentially said, some people are better than others. Some are superior than others. And,
mm-hmm.
and a system that actually used religion to justify that kind of violence and denigration of others. And along with that, you know, my own emerging awareness of my sexuality as a gay man and what that meant to actually travel the journey, which was a decades-long journey for me of
right.
Say, you know, there is something beloved about me and magnificent about me. And so the book really, you know, I use very personal stories for introducing each of the seven pathways by way of saying to the reader and to your listener who reads the book, your stories are very important. The those significant moments in your life, those truths that you've come to embrace and accept that maybe you've struggled with, are all part of what ultimately reveals some profound inner beauty about you, and that the world needs that from you as much as you need to claim that. Because I really came to believe out of the South African experience that you know, we are profoundly interconnected, that we need one another desperately as members of the human family. And for much of my own experience, that was sort of shaped by this African concept of Ubuntu, which says essentially that, you know, we're only a person in the context of other people. We're not solitary beings. Or as the, you know, the Mayan concept of you are the other me, I am the other you, really makes clear, and that I think is so beautiful when we ground our lives in that truth. So the book uses both my personal experiences and story and the stories of other people to say it is in the ordinariness of our life that we discover profound universal truth about our place in the universe. But it's also within our own story and life that we discover spiritual wisdom and the spiritual guru who resides within each one of us. And I think so often, Susan, you know, we look for those moments of, you know, perhaps nirvana or some great experience that sort of is removed from the course of our everyday life. And those experiences are wonderful. I've had those, and I'm sure that many of your listeners have. But I think the truth is that it's in the grittiness and the ordinariness of everyday life that we discover the invitation to a new way to be human and to becoming fully alive.
And one thing that really struck me in your book, and maybe it's because it's my personal lesson at the time to have this lesson reinforced, is that your opportunities really do come to you. You don't have to seek them out. They find you now sometimes you might be guided to, you know, to go to a certain place in order to have the opportunity happen, but the things that are on your path really do come into your life without your having to go out and seek them. And that happened to you. That happened to many of the stories in your book. And that was just something that, we have these incredible things to overcome in life that seem overwhelming. It was kind of like when you were asked to put the homeless people in your church parking lot, and it was in Seattle, right? Is that
yes,
correct?
It was.
Right. Well, you overcame that with a really wonderful way of framing it so that it would not be so confrontational with the government or the city government. Would you like to tell our listeners about that? Because I think it's really amazing how the things come to us and we go, oh, no, I can't possibly do that. And then yet, if you continue and you do your meditation and speak to the people around you and ask for guidance, the guidance comes, and then you actually can do it. So you're not asked to do anything you can't do.
Yes, exactly. And the astounding thing, Susan, is that when we respond to those and are aware of them, we discover these incredible resources that our life has actually prepared us for.
Right, exactly.
Unbeknownst to us. And we discover that there is a circle of people in our life who also help, you know, nurture mm-hmm. us, birth us for this new moment. And I love to think of those moments as moments of new birth for us.
Right.
You know, I talk in the book two of these seven spiritual pathways. One is risky invitations, and the other is the hairpin curves of life. And,
right.
And I begin the hairpin curves of life by telling the story of arriving in Seattle in 1999 to lead a very prominent public institution with a very visible space on the city skyline, really overlooking mm-hmm. the city of Seattle. And, you know, the place was fraught with all sorts of issues. There'd been embezzlement, and, I mean, there was just, you know, it felt like
a typical institution.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I'm there on the job for about 2.5 months, and somebody walks into my office and says, there's this group called Tent City. It's a homeless encampment, and I'd heard about them, certainly, and I knew that the city of Seattle wanted nothing more than to shut them down and move mm-hmm. them out of town as quickly as possible. And
right.
So this person says, you know, they'd really like you to invite them to come and be on the grounds here for a month. And my heart sank. You know, I had been involved with early responses to homelessness in the 80s mm-hmm. in the New York area as people were released, you know, from institutions and you know, communities across the U.S. had suddenly had homeless people on the streets that
right.
they were ill-equipped to deal with. So when I left New York to move to Seattle, I thought, oh, well, my days of, you know, working with the homeless are probably over. This is a new chapter in my life, and we should never make assumptions about our journey.
No.
Life has a sense of humor, I think, and all of its own. And so after, you know, thinking, oh, this is the last thing that I want to deal with right now,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that it was also just a political hot potato.
Right.
And I thought, you know, that's not the right response, Robert. I talk in the book about hairpin curves of life. Certainly this example is being those events that throw your life off balance by interrupting your routine and security and path. And I say that they shake you up and point to really unexpected invitations. But at the same time, they draw you into new experiences of being embraced by life and you yourself, as I experienced, becoming more fully alive. And so, you know, I think part of the response that I had to this request came from being in touch with two things that I talk about as tools for the spiritual journey, intuition and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, it's the hospitable thing to do, to welcome the stranger and the homeless and those in need. And so that's sort of a no-brainer almost. There's no way of turning back from that.
Right.
But what if we did something different at the same time and extended a second invitation to gather people from corporate leadership, from foundations, from social service agencies, from government, the homeless themselves, interfaith leaders, rabbis and clergy and imams and so on, and brought everyone together to imagine and talk about a new way of responding to homelessness.
Right.
And it was one of those moments of, wow, I would never have thought of that. If this invitation had not been presented, and if this hairpin curve had not been thrown my way. And so that's what we did. Mm-hmm. And, the sky didn't fall in. And there were astounding responses to the homeless, who suddenly got to be experienced by many as ordinary people, just like you and me, wanting a happy life, wanting the basics of life. And out of that emerged, a countywide initiative, developing a plan to end homelessness within 10 years and rethink the way in which it was done and moving beyond just emergency responses. And what was remarkable was to see folks who used to work in silos before and who were protective of their own particular program and its funding and all of their data. It was all their stuff, actually.
Right.
Beginning to discover another way of working together with a sense of common purpose. And I'm glad you liked that story in the book, because I think the story is, you know, while it's about the specifics of that particular invitation and moment, I believe that it points to a truth about life, that the universe invites us to those moments of imagining what our common life can be like together, in which we actually work collaboratively to bring about good and to help polish the world. And I think, Susan, one of the themes that I keep hearing people comment on about the book as I'm on this national book tour right now is that many people say, you know, so many books that are self-help, self-improvement, spirituality are just about me and my own inner work. And say your book does that and honors the importance of that, but it also says that there's more, that it's not just about us, that it's about how we are and who we are with every little word and action that we do and take.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong, it was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677.
Please join us every Saturday morning for Temple of Health Radio Show, brought to you by Plastico's and Millennium Healthcare. Our holistic medical practices in Atlanta are committed to community education. Our shows bring you national authors on topics of health alternatives, new scientific breakthroughs, and spiritual medicine.
Well, The Course in Miracles says that the curricula for all of us is the same, but the time we take is up to us. And I think probably what your book showed me is that we don't take the curricula alone. We take it with guidance and with the help of others around us. And these are the things you talk about in your book. I mean, we all need to learn to walk this path, that it is a path, number one, that we, you know, it's a path that's sort of perhaps for the most part predetermined like a curricula, and that each of us has opportunities to learn the lesson and graduate on to the next lesson. And you've just had some very interesting interesting paths that you've walked down.
Well, I love that you make that connection with that teaching from the Course in Miracles, Susan. It's a great thing. yes, I believe that that life keeps presenting us with unexpected companions for the journey, and mm-hmm. some of those companions walk with us, you know, for long periods through our life, and maybe for much of our life, and others seem to just appear at the right time and are there for 6 or 12 or 24 months or whatever it might be. And it's almost as though life and the universe itself seems to know our need for the next awakenings that we're being invited into. And I do believe that we are invited to new awakenings more often than perhaps we are aware of. And so I think one of the things that I try to do in the book is to give readers tools for both being awake and aware to what those opportunities are from life and from the universe. And I think it's really true in this day and age when we are so, you know, connected to technology and we're in often sensory overload. And I love all of the new technology. I give thanks for it. And I think it's one of the most exciting and dramatic transformative moments in human history because of all of that technology. But I think the shadow side of it is that often we're so busy, you know, responding to emails because we know that they have to be responded to instantly, or text messages, or whatever it is, that we don't sort of take the time to say it's really important for me to be grounded. And
yeah.
I think sometimes we get overwhelmed by thinking, oh, to be grounded and to meditate means I need to do half an hour or an hour of it every day. And so we simply say, I can't do that, and we don't do it. And what I offer in the book are some simple techniques for taking meditation breaks in the course of the day, or thinking about how you're actually going to choose to approach each day, because I do believe we make choices. Life doesn't just sort of randomly happen.
No.
But we make choices to be present to it. You know, somebody asked me at a book event a few weeks ago, they said, well, Robert, could you just share a tool of how you think about every day and are grounded? And they said, well, there are several things, but one that I use regularly is to take a few minutes at the start of each day, as I'm paying attention to my own breath, and I visualize each person I have an appointment with. Now, most of those that I've got an appointment with over the phone, or in person, I either know, or, you know, I've seen their photograph on their website or whatever. And so I visualize being present with that person, and being an attentive listener to the conversation that will happen or the meeting that will take place. And then I said, I also take time to invite mindfulness about being present to the people who I do not know, who I'm going to meet that day. And it might be an encounter with, you know, the clerk at the grocery store who's checking out my, the things I've bought in the store, who says something about their life or about the day that if you are present to it, it's like, wow, this is a moment of human connection that is important to my day and to the the day of the other person. So I offer tools in the book that are very sort of simple. I also suggest, I happen to love to cook, and I love food, and I particularly enjoy all of the ways in which we can cook really healthy and exciting foods that are good for our body, but are filled with wonderful flavors. And so I tend to do a lot of chopping and sauteing of different things and flavors melding together. And I talk in the book about feasting. And, you know, most of us think about feasting as a sort of a special event, or those gathering around our table. And I suggest some tools for, you know, really being mindful about those who are coming to dinner or to lunch or whatever it might be, and to invite everyone to be present to being aware of the very best in each person who will gather, and to be able to really be aware of one another. But I also suggest that there are other opportunities for feasting that are perhaps more common. You know, you and I mean, if we were together, we might be going out to have coffee for 20 or 25 minutes. And I suggest that those encounters that are much more common in our daily routine are opportunities to really be experienced as a feast, that I can turn off my cell phone or turn off the ringer, that I don't need to actually, unless there's an emergency going on, be responding to a text while you and I are talking over coffee, that I can set that aside for just a short period of time and actually be fully present with you. That's a feast.
Yeah, Ron Dass had a story about how important this mindfulness is. He said he was in a hurry to get somewhere, and someone that he knew, not real well, but, you know, casually, maybe someone working in the area, came up to him and asked to speak to him about something, but he was too busy, had to go. And then later he found that that person had committed suicide. So, you know... You do have to be aware that sometimes it's better to be late if you're guided to. You know, there are things that do come up that may seem very minor, but actually you need to be present and aware so that you can get the instruction that, no, you need to take even just 5 minutes to speak to this person.
Absolutely. And those what we often see as interruptions in our routine or our
life. Right, yeah, because we're so busy
usually,
and, you know, scheduled.
Yeah, we're so busy. And, you know, whenever I say, you know, oh, I'm so busy, what I'm really saying is, gee, aren't I important?
Right, and that's what he was saying in the book. He said he was beginning to think of himself as important. You know, his book, Be Here Now, was out, and you know, it was a real lesson in humility for him that he wasn't listening.
Yeah, well, you know, I love that story. I mean, it's a sad story in terms of what happened to the person who took her or his own life. But I tell some stories that really sort of express something of that same yearning and theme in my book, A New Way to Be Human.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about, you know, being at the gym one morning early. And, you know, there was someone who I said hello to and who'd helped me work out at one point. And I was leaving, and I was, you know, waiting for the elevator at the gym to go down to the parking lot. And I was thinking about the day ahead and all of my appointments and, you know, gee, aren't I busy? And, you know, and this person was just sort of lingering. He'd been waiting for me at the elevator. And he got on with me and he said, gee, I'd really like to speak with you. Can I come and see you today? And I said, oh, there's someone on my staff, you know, just call the main number and someone will see you. And I get off the elevator and we said, you know, gee, have a great day or something. And as I'm walking to the car, I thought, oh my gosh, Robert, he wasn't asking to speak to somebody on your staff.
Yeah,
there's something going on in his life. He wanted to speak to you right now.
Right. Right.
And I thought, whoa, I was not aware. I was not present, but
right, you
thank
weren't.
Goodness, I am aware right now. And I walked the parking lot and I found him. And we actually ended up spending time together that day. And I realized that there was something important about his life that he needed to talk about. Right. And it didn't take long out of in the course of my day. I also tell a story of, you know, I was driving from, we live both in Seattle and in rural eastern Washington, and I had to get to an event and drive over the Cascade Mountains, and I was headed to this, you know, really important meeting that I felt honored to be included in, and was with a well-known international person, and we were going to do some filming, and you know, so I'm driving on this 3.5-hour trip, and suddenly there's road construction, and the traffic is backed up for miles.
We've all been there.
And yeah, and you know, I think why I tell these stories is because they are about the ordinariness of our life,
they
and
are.
It's not just you know me who's had them. We've all had them, and I love the fact that when you said that, you laughed about it because I do think that we're invited to have some self not self deprecating, but some self aware humor, And I'm getting out of the car as other people were and, you know, walking about, and I'm looking at these beautiful Cascade Mountains with snow on the peaks, and it was springtime and there was still snow, and I'm thinking, oh, this is beautiful. Robert, you can just be anxious about this meeting and being late for it, and you can obsess about it, or you can just settle into this moment and say, this is a moment that's teaching me something. I have a way to communicate with people, and I'm going to let them know I'm going to be late. And as I sat there, I started, as I let go of my anxiety and then all the pressure I was feeling. And, you know, I think I'm a relatively grounded person, and my point is, no matter how grounded any of us are, we feel that anxiety and pressure, and it's real, and it's okay to say that. And in
I have a dear friend from South Africa who, for my birthday, gave me a plaque. It says, on time is when I get there. You know, you just can't.
Don't you love that?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a surgeon. I'm in surgery. Surgery runs over. Everybody's waiting. We try to tell them to come late, but with traffic and everything, they can't do that. You know, people wait for me. So instead of being anxious all the time that I'm late, because I'm late a lot, I just, you know, on time is when I get there. You know, it's like it's a mindset. It's a, you know, you only have your daily bread of energy. You know, you only have your energy for the day. You might as well not waste it with things you can't control. You can't control the traffic. You know.
Yep. In that story, I actually say that experience, once I'd settled into it, I then started to imagine a slightly different way of thinking about the appointment that I was going to. And so it turned out to be an incredible gift that I would not have had if I hadn't been stuck in the traffic and been invited to just be present and say, wow, I'm also part of this incredible magnificence of creation around me, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Gave you a minute to smell the roses.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that. My mom died on Monday, and we had hospice in the house, and and she received a gift from one of her favorite nieces who lives in New Zealand, and she sent a silk scarf, a black silk scarf, and she said, Auntie, I'm hoping this will bring you a little glam, even in your hospice bed. Mm-hmm. And then she sent, because she knows my mother gardened for years and was a magnificent gardener and loved flowers, and she sent a sachet of rose scent. You know, those kind of sachets that you might put in an underwear or lingerie drawer or something to scent things. And my mom was lying there almost barely able to speak. It was her last day. And she put a sachet on her left shoulder so that she could smell it. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, to hear you say, you know, smell the roses, I mean, she was literally doing that. And I believe that unexpected gift sent from halfway across the world, the simplest of gifts, you know, a little sachet smelling of roses, brought incredible joy and a reminder
to my dying mother of the flowers and the gardens that had been so much a part of her metaphor for life that she couldn't see from her bed, but she was suddenly invited to be aware of their smell and their fragrance. And, you know, most of us, you know, are not in that particular situation, but I think life presents us with those moments to be reminded of what is really beautiful and earthy and grounding in our life.
Yeah, I think we need to celebrate the times of transition. You know, the people so often don't realize that these are sacred times, the times of birth with the family being involved and the times of death with the family being involved. They're sacred transitions. All of us will go through it. I mean, we're not, you know, as they say, nobody gets out of life alive. So, you know, we're all going to go through it. So why not understand that it is sacred? It's a sacred transition.
Yeah. You know, it's wonderful to hear you say that. I have one sibling, and he and his partner and me and my spouse were constantly through all of this, you know, over the last weeks. We were on conference calls. We used this wonderful ability that I didn't even know I had on my iPhone to page people into calls. So, you know, we were able to, you know, them on the East Coast, us on the West Coast, we were able to constantly be talking about, you know, the latest discharge plan or, you know, our mom's desire to actually go home and to not be in the hospital and to have the dignity of being in her own place that she loved. And
I think that's important, personally.
You know,
I think I've seen a lot of people die in hospitals.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And, and you know, we had amazing, amazing care in the hospital. But there was a time when it seemed appropriate to say, you know, it's no longer okay to be in the hospital and to die at home.
Both my parents went through hospice, and I was just amazed at how much hospice has advanced and how good hospice is.
It is really quite remarkable. And, you know, so I think to your point of, you know, death being a transition, it's also a moment of some new birth. I mean, I just think of the incredible closeness that the four of us had as members of the family, which, you know, in my experience is in such contrast to sometimes the sort of strife that emerges when people have not been in communication or have had unresolved issues about, you know, a dying parent or a sibling, perhaps some unresolved anger. And I think those times are invitations to also say, gee, do I really want to hang on to this anger that I feel towards dad or mom or my brother or whoever? Or is there something else that life is inviting me to learn right now? And those are choices.
Yeah, I think when you have these unresolved emotions with people who die, your level of grief is much more. I've noticed that in my patients who've had spouses die or children die. When the relationship is rocky, the grief is much more profound, which is very interesting.
I think
not always. I mean, sometimes in marriages when a spouse dies, the grief is profound because of the breakup of the, you know, the bonding, the relationship. I'm not saying it's always like that, but it's interesting. When the relationships are more complete, then letting that person go is a lot easier.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. And when the relationships are not as complete, you then see it being played out, not just in, you know, at the time of death and, you know, sort of arguments over what the funeral is going to be like, if there's going to be one. But also, often I'm surprised at people who fight over, have these huge family battles over, you know, whether someone gets, you know, mom's favorite, you know, coffee mugs or things that are ultimately of no significance in the scheme of things, but that become the object of a battle. And that is what I talk about in the book as life-draining energy, because it encloses us from one another.
Right.
And I think that the part of what I offer in the book are tools for actually both knowing your own belovedness and magnificence, which helps you to be present to that of others, including family members, but also some practices for detachment, because sometimes we do need to detach from relationships that are toxic or that sap life-draining energy.
Mm-hmm. That's true. The other thing that in your journey and also in the journey of the Dalai Lama, you know, people think that if you become spiritual and you have this life where you meditate and everything's, you know, calm and peaceful and, you know, you're perfectly protected. Well, this is not true. You know, you had to leave South Africa. You know, I want our listeners to understand that you actually, because of your work in South Africa, you had to leave or you would be imprisoned, you know. So tell them a little bit about that. And, of course, the Dalai Lama had to, was it he 16 when he had to sneak out of Tibet with the Chinese army looking for him? I mean, it's certainly not just all meditation and sweetness and roses. It just isn't. But then you get to use your guidance a lot more. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, in my case, because of my anti-apartheid work, I, you know, had some encounters with the secret police, nothing like many people had in South Africa. But was very, very aware of the power and the desire to control and silence voices. Mm-hmm. And so I talk a lot in the book about the importance and the power and the life-giving energy of claiming your own voice and your own story. But I had come through all of that to believe that I would not serve in the South African military, which at the time was compulsory for all white males for an initial two-year right. period and then up 3 months. Every year until, I don't know, something like the age of 40 or 45, because the system depended upon the military for enforcing its policies. And so I decided I was going to go to jail. You either had to serve, leave the country, or go to jail. And leaving was not an option for me. And so I went, actually, to see Desmond Tutu and ask for his blessing, for his guidance. And it was our first one-on-one meeting, and he asked me this remarkable question, which left me frozen in a state of anxiety for about 30 seconds. He said, Robert, tell me who you are, not what you've done. Now, you know, I think you and I know, and your listeners probably know, that, boy, you walk into a party or a business meeting or whatever, and people always, the first thing out of their mouth is, hi, I'm Robert, or I'm Susan, and what do you do?
Right.
And this question was so different. So I started to tell him about my spinal surgeries and having had this moment of falling out of bed and being terrified that I might have damaged the work that the surgeons had done. At the time, I had to be flat on my back for 6 weeks. And a nurse came, and after determining that I was okay, put me back in bed. And then she came and sat next to my bed, bringing mugs of hot chocolate, and she held my hand. And we sat for an hour and chatted, and I told her that I was lonely in the hospital because visiting time was limited to 30 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And we started to talk about what I was reading when I spoke about this book called by a guy called Trevor Huddleston, who basically told stories about a remarkable multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious community in South Africa called Sophiatown that had been raised from the face of the earth by the government because it didn't fit with their view of how people should be kept apart rather than celebrating life together. Mm-hmm. And so I'm telling, you know, to the story in response to his question, tell me who you are, and because it had shaped me so much. And so I get to the point of saying, you know, the nurse was leaving the room and she stopped and paused and said, you know, Robert, you've actually had a very good visitor in Mr. Huddleston. And at that moment, Tutu just started laughing. And, you know, I was 22 years old. He was 49. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what have I said?
Right.
Now, he settled down and he finally said to me, you know, Robert, when I was a teenager, I spent long periods of time in the hospital with tuberculosis. And just like you, I was lonely and afraid. And Trevor Huddleston was my pastor. And he used to come and visit me and read stories to me. So this, you know, it was this remarkable moment. And I tell the story by way of saying that each of our stories usually connects us to unexpected people when we know and can tell the story, and we never know where it's going to lead us. And in that moment, you know, I think he and I realized that there were shared transformation decades apart, brought about by the same person. But if I hadn't told that story, we would never have known that.
Right.
And we then quickly started to talk about, you know, Mike going to jail. And he said, you know, there will be a time when that is important, but this mm-hmm. is not that time, which is an amazing degree of self-awareness on his part.
Yeah.
And he said, I will get you out. And literally within 10 days, I was on my way out of South Africa on a plane to the U.S. and actually watched by members of the secret police who had been following me,
mm-hmm.
watched at the airport as I said goodbye to my family. And, you know, not knowing up until the last minute if I'd actually be allowed to go or not. So, yes, you know, our spiritual grounding doesn't keep us from the difficult moments of life. But what it does do is provide us with some inner resources for how to respond to them.
Mm-hmm.
I tell one of the pathways in the book is called Home in Your Heart, and I suggest that home for us, for each of us, is a physical and emotional, as well as an intellectual and spiritual destination. And I say that, you know, when we're always searching for your one true home, you live a kind of a homeless way of life. But I suggest that you can choose a journey to a seamless experience of home by intentionally navigating the landscapes that have shaped you. Because most of us have many landscapes in our life and people who really create home for us. And I actually tell the story in there of a remarkable experience with my dad when he was leaving the U.S. after visiting me in 1982. And I'd been in the country for 2 years and didn't know that I'd ever be able to go back to South Africa because we didn't know how long mm-hmm. apartheid would last for. And my dad was just not a man given to, you know, emotional intimacy. He'd never really been taught how to do any of that and felt uncomfortable. But there we were at JFK. It was, you know, pre-9/11. You could still, in those days, go to the boarding gate with people
right.
and say goodbye. And there we were in all of the chaos of JFK. And my dad just very quietly said to me, I love you. I don't know when we'll see each other again. And there were tears in his eyes. And of course, tears started welling inside of me. And then he held me close and caressed my head and kissed me. And it was a kiss that I will never forget. I'm sure my dad kissed me when I was a little baby.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt like, you know, as I kissed and hugged him in return, I was just overwhelmed by this unexpected gift that seemed to be of just immeasurable worth from him. And
mm-hmm.
as I told him that I loved him, I wondered if I would be able to stop this avalanche of tears. And I reflected as he left to board the plane on our hearts as a human labyrinth of love. And mm-hmm. I began to wonder that day what it meant for each of us to leave part of our heart in one place where it still lives. And so I write this pathway as a way of inviting, you know, your listeners and readers of the book to think about the many places and people who form home for us and how to integrate that into a life of personal wholeness.
Right, yeah. It's a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it. I want to share a story with you about Bernie Siegel. I see that he's on the back of your book. Bernie, of course, is the author of Love, Medicine, and Miracles. And I had interviewed, I had a TV show for 6 years, and I've had this radio show for 15 years. So I've interviewed Bernie Siegel now and again as his books came out. But when I was writing my book, The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, which is a kind of a politically incorrect book, shall we say, about the science that they want to suppress about chemical silicone and biotoxicity. One of the people that I was guided to have on the back of the book actually needed to write a much larger thing than a little blurb. It was the main silicone researcher, so I had asked him to just write the prefix, or actually the foreword to the book. And so I had a place on the back of the book because I had Larry Dossey and Norm Shealy. And I kept being guided to send Bernie Siegel the book. You know, it was like very strong. Send it to Bernie. Send it to Bernie. So I sent it to him, and he read it, and he said, he contacted me and said, "Oh, my God, my family has the HLA type, the genetic type that's affected by this. I never knew it existed before your book." And he thanked me, and then he wrote something on the back of my book. So you see, they're the stories. You know, I had some scientific information because of my research into this that he, even as a cancer surgeon, didn't know, and yet his family needed to know that. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, but what a wonderful gift. I mean, I had chills as I listened to that. Wow. And, you know, I'm hearing that, Susan, that you also are deeply in touch with your intuition and your imagination, because you listened to this sense inside of you that Bernie needed to read your book, and that you needed him to read it. He's really an amazing guy, and I'm thrilled to have him endorse the book along with Deepak Chopra and some others.
Chopra,
so
Yeah, it's great. It really is. But we are, I just tell the story to show that we all are interconnected, and that when you get guidance to contact somebody, even if you're not sure why you're doing it at the time, I mean, that's okay. You know, you don't always have a good idea of what's ahead of you, but you have to have the faith that you need to walk on the path that's being shown for you to walk on, and it'll be explained later.
You know, I love that you say that, because I think so often we've all been there in our lives. We think, gee, I've got to have the full answer to this. I've got to fully understand it. And I think
we need to control it.
None of us. Well, exactly. It's about letting go of that control and saying, you know, the truth is, I really don't have all the answers to everything, and I never will do. I can only operate out of this. Paying attention to what my intuition is leading me to, or what some unexpected invitation from somebody is connecting me with. And I don't need to know all the answers, because if I know all the answers, then I'm not going to
be any
open
fun.
Aware of the weight. You know, it'd be boring. Absolutely
no
boring.
Adventure.
No, I just complete control. Yeah.
That's really true. I mean, I do via meditation and other spiritual practices, I do strive to develop spiritual sight and hearing. But in no time do I want nothing to be a surprise. You know, at no time do I want to know everything about everybody and everything and myself. And no, that's not the goal. The goal is to come here and have fun. I think that's the goal.
Well, I'm pleased to say that, because, you know, the seventh pathway of the book is really about cultivating gladness and joy and delight.
It is.
Those are spiritual qualities, but I also believe, you know, that there's something that the universe itself is full of. You know, you've just got to look at creation all around us and some of the funny creatures that exist. I mean, you know, you can't help but laugh when you see something like a giraffe or a zebra, you know. They invite you to smile. And, you know, my dog, Lucy, invites me to smile and be playful all the time. And I believe that daily life is replete with invitations to find delight. in the simplest of ordinary day moments. And so I offer that to readers of the book as one of the tools on a new way to be human, at which we stop clutching at life and we let go of what we think we know and enter into the present that each day invites us to make that choice to do.
That's true. I spent 13 years in the Air Force as a surgeon, and I was often reminded by the fighter pilots whenever there was a major challenge that it was actually a good humor check. You know, are you going to respond to it by getting unhappy, or are you going to laugh?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
That's good. It's a good humor check. How's your humor today?
So, my humor is good today. How's yours?
Yeah, I think we're doing well. I think everything's real well.
Good.
Do you have a contact information you'd like to give?
Yeah, you know, your listeners can certainly find out more about the book, A New Way to Be Human, and certainly about me and my work and where I'm speaking around the country at my website, which is Robert V. That's V as in Vincent, Taylor. So it's robertvtaylor.com. They'll also find on the website an opportunity to sign up for a free subscription to a weekly inspirational message that I send out. And then there's information on where to order the book, but you know that's pretty simple. It's available on Barnes and Noble on their website and Amazon, and it's in most indie bookstores around the country. And Barnes and Noble in their bricks and mortar stores are actually promoting the book nationwide right now. So
great.
And the book is available it's a paperback edition that people can buy, or else it's also available as an e-reader. And I know for many people that's really important to have it on their Kindle or Nook or iPad.
Right, right. Yeah, it makes books a lot more affordable for a lot of people.
Well, it sure does.
Great.
Convenient.
It is. Well, we're coming up to the last 5 minutes or so. Is there any messages you'd like to leave with our listeners, any insights?
Well, you know, I just hope that your listeners, and I'm sure this is true for them, if they're listening to the wisdom that you have revealed in your show, that life is invited, it is an invitation, and that we're invited to this journey of becoming fully alive, and that we do it when we stop clutching at life as we imagine that it should be, and instead allow ourselves to be grounded, to be centered, to be open, to be aware and awake about what life presents to us each and every day. And I think I would say to your listeners, you know, your story that you might think is kind of mundane is not mundane at all. It reveals beauty and it reveals spiritual truth in the most ordinary of moments. And claim it, be grounded in it, be centered in it, and share it with others. Because when you start to do that, you listen attentively to their stories, and then you experience the universal truths and wisdom that is revealed in their life journey. And so all of that is by way of saying that invites us to celebrate our oneness and our interconnectedness and how much we need each other. And I guess I would say also to your listeners that one of the things I've learned over the decades of doing this work is that the journey itself blesses you. When you trust and settle into the journey and make choices to do that every day, that the journey blesses you and gives you courage and allows your heart space to expand so that your own sense of your belovedness and how much you are loved unconditionally for who you are, with all of the wonder and the shame and the regret and the joy that is part of your story and my story and the story of each of us, that when you're able to hold all of that as in an integrated whole space, your heart space expands, your compassion for yourself and therefore for other people expands, and you start to discover a sense of happiness about life. And I don't mean the kind of happiness that comes from, you know, driving a Prius or a Mini Cooper, but the kind of happiness that emerges when you and I are centered on our well-being. Because when I care about my well-being and you care about your well-being, we can't help but care about the well-being of others. And then every little thing that we do begins to help polish and change the world. And that is a wonderful, enlivening way to be alive.
Well, that was a wonderful statement of hope and advice for people who are wanting a new way to be human. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. We've been interviewing Robert Taylor, the author of A New Way to Be Human, Seven Spiritual Pathways to Becoming Fully Alive. Robert's had a remarkable life, guidance in and out of danger and helping others and learning so much. And he shares it in his book, and I think that he shares what he's learned about the pathways that we can all take. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Susan Ann Taylor, The Hidden Power of Your Past Lives, Revealing Your Encoded Consciousness. And then Michael Murray will be back on the 26th with Why in the World Are They Spraying? In June, Jacob Teitelbaum will be with us. Dr. Teitelbaum is probably the world expert on fibromyalgia. He has a book called Real Cause, Real Cures. And then Stephen Lewis with the Ames Program will be back on the 9th. And then we're going to veer away from our health topic on the 16th. Nick Rearfern, Keep Out Top Secret Places Governments Don't Want You to Know About. That'll be a little diversion from the health topic. We have a Millennium Healthcare event, Curing Food Allergies by Dr. Mike Greenberg on the 22nd at the Dunwoody office at 7:30. And on the 17th, Noetic Science, Dr. Brad Gould is talking about light therapy, also at 7:30 on the 17th. And on the 21st of June, we will have another Noetic Science meeting as we do every third Thursday. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us. Robert, thanks a lot. I appreciate talking with you.
It was a
lot
of fun. What a joy to be with you.
And join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.